Double-decker here. Next week, Mrs. Shira Smiles is coming to speak here, Sunday, May 15th at 8 p.m. The topic is Lessons from the Frightening Fall, Perspectives on the Downs of Life. I also want to mention that many of us have heard about the Shira tonight and other Shira because they're on an email list. Jody Rosenthal is kind enough to send many of us emails about Shira in the community as well as other events. So if anyone is interested in having their name added to the list, do we have a list outside, Jody?
Yeah.
There's a list outside. You can just add your email if you like. Okay, here we are. Thank you so much for coming. Especially like to thank the sponsors who made this night possible. The shir is being given Nishmas Devora, Yehuda Bas Moshe Yasachar, Aaron Ben David HaKohen, Tzivia Ben Menachem Mendel, Avraham Yehuda Ben Aaron, Michael Yosef Ben Yosef, Chaya Ruda Bas Chaim, Chaya Henya Bas Mordechai Chaim, Shlomo Ben David, Yaakov Yosef Ben Nata, Bina Bas Svi, Sarah Leah Bas Moshe, Bracha Yita Bas David. The shir is also being given in honor of the birthday of Sarah Bas Chaya Rachel, and as a schus for Yehuda Moshe Ben Leah and for the Refuah Shalema of Mera Guta Bas Bela, Levi Ben Shimon and Edel Chaya Basketo. I think most of us are very familiar with Mrs. Heller, for those who aren't. She's an internationally known speaker. She's been at Neve Yerushalayim for many, many years, bringing women from all walks of life, young, old, closer to Hashem, back to Yiddishkeit. Reb Tzin Heller has many sforim and tapes of shirim. She has a beautiful website as well where you can listen to shirim and read many of her articles. We have some sforim and tapes on sale, if anyone would like. And here we are. Okay. Mrs. Heller?
So we're going to talk about what to do with these turbulent times. Where do we put ourselves in them? Now, being Jewish, you could find yourself saying, what do you mean these turbulent times? When didn't we have turbulent times? You know, like you look at our history and you say, gosh, I should have lived in a more tranquil, predictable era, like when the Jews left Egypt. Okay, no. During the time of the conquest of the land, no. The era of the judges, Okay, let's move like more contemporarily. All of our medieval history was like hallmarked by tranquility, prosperity, and predictability. Okay, move up a little bit further. So the question is why we're even talking about it. So in order to understand why virtually all Gedolei Torah see our era as somehow different, we have to talk about what we know about cycles and time in Judaism. So I want to begin by giving you two pictures. One is Ramban's picture, and the other is going to be the general picture of cycles within the Torah itself. Here's Ramban's picture. He asks this question, quoting Rashi, why does the Torah begin with a creation? The Torah is about telling you what to do, how to respond to reality. Why have all of this narrative? So Rashi answers a very, very puzzling, enigmatic sort of an answer. Well, we have to know that God created the world because one day the nations of the world will say, I know this is inconceivable for you to imagine, you're thieves. You've stolen the land of seven nations. Could you imagine them saying that? You know, I know it's a stretch, try to, okay, whatever. And your answer to them was, God created the world, it belongs to him, he gave it to you, took it from you, and gave it to us. Okay, and that's why we have to know God created the world. This is a very difficult Rashi, is it not? What's he talking about? So what Rashi is talking about here isn't whether or not we have to know that there's a God. What we have to know is God's relationship to the world. The relationship he has to the world is that he's taking it somewhere. So there are two ways of looking at history. How many of you studied history in university? Any of you? Okay. So you might recall, if unless your subconscious blocked it out, that the way people usually learn history is linearly. First there's this, which led to that, and that led to the other. You know, like we were living in caves and then city-states, and before you know it, there's the Astrodome in Texas with fake grass. Okay, and that's what it all leads to. So that's one way of looking at history. Okay, serious academicians don't look at it that way. They see cycles. Arguably, the most renowned 20th century historian was Toynbee, who the two people who raised their hand when they said who studied history heard his name at least. He wrote a very extensive and encyclopedic work on the world's history called Civilizations, in which he studied over 2,000 civilizations. It gets very boring. Okay, the Subgoths. Don't you want to know more about the Subgoths? Why not? Okay, whatever. And he discovered they all have one pattern, which is that people group together in order to deal with challenges, flourish, become complacent, and are replaced by a younger, fresher civilization. Could you see where this is true? Okay, now he had a problem. His problem was that the Jews don't fit the paradigm. We don't fit it. So you know what his conclusion was? We're a sub-race. Some people thought he was anti-Semitic. I didn't know why people are so defensive. Okay, whatever. But the fact is there's nothing about our history that fits anybody's paradigm. Not only doesn't it fit Toynbee's paradigm of drawing together to meet challenges, that's certainly not what draws us together throughout the last 2,000 years. We were very disparate all over the world. Different challenges, different groupings, yet we were all Jews. We are replaced by fresher, younger civilizations and disappear. We have this, at least to some people's, annoying habit of non-disappearance. So it's puzzling. So another take of what draws people together is land, language, and culture. But for the last 2,000 years, we haven't lived in our land, don't speak a common language, and certainly don't have a common culture. Is that true? So the idea of our uniqueness is that God chose us for a specific destiny. And in order to do that, we have to know who owns the world. So I want to bring this up to a more contemporary play. I was talking to a man the other night, a very intelligent man, a lawyer, and he was saying that the legitimacy of the State of Israel is dependent on this, that the United Nations acknowledged it at its founding. But the State of Israel that it acknowledged was a very tiny little state. They acknowledged Israel as it was in borders that were proposed by the British in 1945. The borders of 1948 were borders that are somewhat larger. And therefore, his theory was that if we want to be acknowledged as being legitimate in our presence in the Mideast, we have to go back to the 1945 borders. Okay? So the premise underlying that is that the British or the United Nations have the right to apportion land. historically, how was land apportioned? By war. Make no mistake. By war. Okay, the Americans are here not because the Native Americans, in their generosity and kindness, felt that they should grant their land to the white conquerors. The English are in England not because the Celts felt that it was time to go. It's through conquest and war. And the feeling that's developed in the course of world history when you look at it is the conquest and war, if it's solid and permanent, defines borders. Could you see where this is so? Okay. So all of this would be true up to a certain point in time, when imperialism no longer felt good to people, which was pretty recent. Nonetheless, empires still exist and are continuing to expand. Is this true? It is. Okay, so put all of this aside. This is secular history and their picture of reality. Let's go back to Ramban. So he takes us back to this, that God is the actual decisor of history and its author, and that we could decipher some of it through the narrative. So he takes us to the days of creation. Using the verse in Tehillim, in which it says, a day of God is like 1,000 years, he applies the 6 days of creation to 6 millennia of the world's history. So let's look at this comparison. Day one in the creation. Darkness and light. Okay, he begins measuring creation from Adam, from the first human being. So he says the first millennia of the world's history, measuring it from Adam, was the creation of the first human. The world is dark without human beings. Adam was the first human, and his lifespan included most of the first millennia. In what sense is the world dark without human presence? If you were to take every human off the planet, how would the planet be? Greener, nicer. We're the only beings that can interpret it. When you're talking about light, you're talking about interpretation. If we were to take this room and make it completely dark, everything would still be there. The people, the benches, we just wouldn't see it. Humans have the ability to see the patterns of reality and to make sense of it. Okay, that's the first millennia. Next day of creation. What happened on day two? You have to know this because otherwise your children and grandchildren will think you're stupid. There are two things you have to know in Judaism. You have to know the days of creation, and you have to know the Hebrew months. If you can get past that, you're okay till second grade. Okay, so what was created on day two? The separation. The second millennia, the most central event was the great flood, the separation between the wicked and righteous. Okay, third day of creation. What happened then? Okay, trees, grass, everything that grows. Okay, what happened in the third millennia? It's called the age of flowering and fruition. All of the patriarchs, all of the matriarchs, the Joseph story, the Jews ending up in Egypt, getting out of Egypt, being in the desert, receiving the Torah, and building the Mishkan, all took place within 1,000-year period. It's the age of the world's fruition. Now you could think, boy, that sounds ethnocentric. Okay. So I want to point out that if you were to interview people anywhere, give me the name of any place that you could imagine visiting ever. Long Island. Don't be so exotic. Okay. Say London. Somebody actually said London. If you were to interview every person in London, every person in Jerusalem, every person in Bonn, every person in New Delhi, and say, is your life somewhat different because there was somebody called Abraham who discovered that there's an underlying unity to all things? and laid foundation for what we call basic morality, what would the answer be? Yes. What people today call the Judeo-Christian ethic is what? The ethic of the third day. The end of Avram's life, he had remarried a woman after Sarah's death, he sent his children to the east. Any sense of there being one transcendental spirit from which everything else stems is a result of the wanderings of Avram's children. It's the flowering of the world. Okay, next day. What happened the next day? The luminaries. Okay, so this is the era, again in 1,000-year period, of the two temples, the first and second temple. The first temple is compared to the sun, the second one to the moon. Okay, so you have 410, 420, 7 years, 70 years between. It fits fairly nicely. Next day. Okay, the lower, less sophisticated animals. So in the next 1,000-year period, after the destruction of the second temple, you have what we'll call the lower levels of civilization, conquering each other, battling each other, much as animals do. So when you study history again, those of you who studied history, you'll discover that idealism in warfare is a new invention. Okay, when the Babylonians conquered, it wasn't to make the world safe for democracy. It was because they wanted more land and were pretty open about it. The sixth day, what do you have? The higher level animals, the creation of man. And towards the end of the day, we're moving towards Shabbos. Where are we now in the cycle? What's the Hebrew year? Okay, we're towards the end of the cycle. The higher level animals are the higher level empires. I personally find it interesting that I presume the cultural forces in the Western world haven't read this Ramban in the non-Jewish world, but they give themselves animal symbols. Have you noticed this? The American eagle, the British lion, the Russian bear. Okay, I personally find it very interesting. Okay. So the more contemporary empires are like the higher level animals. They take all of their animal energy and they garb it in idealism. But underneath it, you have animalism. Okay, so the great Russian bear, anybody who's unsophisticated enough to think that Russian imperialism in the communist era was about bettering the lot of the worker, has been asleep for 70 years. Anybody who thinks that World War I was fought about democracy hasn't studied World War I. Anyone who thinks that the Vietnam War had nothing to do with oil in Vietnam whatsoever isn't being real. Underneath the facade of idealism, what you have are animals. But towards the end of the sixth day, you have the creation of man. Okay, so now we have to have a glimpse in Sefer Daniel, who gives us these symbols and their interpretation. He had various visions in which he saw different animals rising from the river. He spoke about the man. To him, the man is a symbol of Mashiach. That the world is going somewhere. All of these cycles are leading somewhere to the humanization of the world in which we live. So we're at the end of the cycle. This is why people look at our times as being different. So we have to talk about is what do we know about what the end of the cycle is meant to look like and how should we respond? Okay, so let's first talk a little bit about Mashiach. I'm not going to stay there very long. And then we're going to go back to what we're going through in the pre-Messianic era, which is going to be the focus of our talk. So when people hear Mashiach, they think, Mashiach, I once heard a secular person who came across somebody who was talking about Mashiach, said, They think that JC's going to come again, only he's going to be Jewish. You know, like, what are we talking about? Who's Mashiach? What's he going to do? When we say he's going to come, how's he going to come? El Al? I had a 30-hour trip, not El Al. Okay, so the Gemara tells us that the soul of Mashiach is here now, has always been here. What's the soul of Mashiach? The soul of Mashiach could be understood from a Gemara that says as follows. The Gemara instructs us, know Mashiach's name. Think, that's not helpful. How should I know his name? What am I supposed to do? Look in the phone book under ma'am? I mean, like, you know. So to help us out, it gives us some possibilities. So one Amora says his name is Menachem. Another says his name is Chizkiah. But then Rabbi Shiloh says his name is Shiloh. And then Rabbi Ami says his name is Ami. And then somebody else says his name is the miscarried child. What's this about? So in order to understand what this is talking about, let's talk about the nature of giving anything a name. When you give something a name, you're defining what it is to you. So if you were an ant, you might call this Mount Everest. It's like, you know, because that's how you see it. Okay, so know Mashiach's name means know your relationship to having the world and yourself come to its ultimate fruition, its ultimate humanization. So in order to know Mashiach's name, we have to know his function. What's he supposed to do? Then we'll go back and talk about his name. So here's what Rambam says. And I'm quoting Rambam because he's the only Rishon who discusses Mashiach. Everything else is derivative or Zoharic. So he says the function of Mashiach is as follows. The day will come, he tells us. Not when we'll be perfect. Not when we'll all do tshuva. Not even, you know, just one shabbos, or whatever. When we'll be shaken enough to want more. To want something more, something better, something different. That's called being educable, which is the proper way to say educatable. Okay, so when that happens, when we're ready for change, then Hashem will send someone, meaning he'll give him the ability to move us forward. So the Vilna Gaon explains this as telling us, look at Egypt. When the Jews were ready to change, when it says in the text they cried out to God, he sent Moshe. Now Moshe was there before, but Hashem enabled Moshe, who was already there. He gave him the charisma and the words and the miracle-making powers to move us. That's messianic function. So the soul of Mashiach, let's go back to the names, is a general soul. What does a general soul mean? Adam was the ancestor of all humans, right? So it means that we all have something in common with each other, which is why we value human life across the board, because Adam provided us with a spiritual soul and body. He's the beginning of the gene pool. That's true? Okay. The word Adam is an acronym for the word Adam, David, Mashiach. Adam is the first person from whom everybody comes. So he's what you call a universal soul. Everyone in the world has what Adam provided them. The fragmentation of the world into later souls after Adam sinned, and mortality and short lifespans as we have today, is because with the world as it is in its present state of lack of tikkun, we're all imperfect, except me, and because of this we're all mortal, we have a certain amount of time using very individual capacities to bring back the wholeness that was there before Adam sinned. So the world, did anyone ever do you the favor of giving you one of those like 5,000 piece puzzles? Did any of you ever have this? Okay, in Israel, they're like very stylish. They're very in. People give them to young couples. I personally think it must have been started by a divorce lawyer, but whatever. Now, imagine trying to put together one of these 5,000-piece puzzles if you have no idea of what it's supposed to look like. Is that possible for most people? No. So the world is like this puzzle. Everybody has to figure out their own piece. The Torah gives us a picture, but each person has to figure out their own piece. Everybody's piece is very specific, just like in this 5,000-piece puzzle. If that like little piece of sky that's this big, if you lose it, the puzzle's not going to fit together. Everyone has something defined and specific that's set forth by their talents, their ability, their genetic heritage, the opportunities they have in life. That's why we can't judge each other, which we tend to do. Okay, the role of Mashiach is to put the pieces together. So David had a universal soul similarly. How many of you say Tehillim, once in a while at least? So if you say Tehillim, what you'll notice is that the occasions upon which David wrote these psalms were hugely varied. He had songs of victory, songs of suffering. Look at his life. He had amazing relationships, and he had tragic relationships. He was rich, but then he was poor. He was a mighty man of war, but he spent his last 13 years invalided. He experienced everything a human could experience. So anyone, if they say Tehillim, will find at least some prakam where they'll say, that's me talking. Have you had that? Okay. Mashiach will be a universal soul. Now let's go back to his names. Menachem, that will bring us comfort. Chizkiah, that'll bring us faith. Strength, rather. But then Rav Ami says his name is Ami. He's like me. He understands me. Rav Shilo will say, no, he's Shiloh. So that means everyone has what I would call a messianic spark, a tzaddik that lives within you that yearns for redemption. So I want to give you an example of how we feel that, that desire to be more, to do more. Okay, so I'll tell you a story. This is a true story, but the purpose of my telling you this story is to make you identify that place within yourself. So I'm already tipping the cards. This is a true story. Now, if you find $10, are you obligated to look for the owner? $10 in cash lying in the street. Are you obligated to look for the owner or not? No. Why not? Because cash, by definition, is unidentifiable. A $10 bill is like every other $10 bill. So nobody could prove to you that it's his $10. Unless it comes in a container or it has an identifying mark or whatever. Maisa Shahaya. There was a couple who were going home from a simcha. How many of you have been to Har Nof? Okay, so you know the simcha halls on Kanfei Nesharim and on Beit Tefus. With typical Israeli grace and charm, the chuppah area faces the parking lot. Okay, so there are quite a number of these halls. A couple were coming home, and the wife is someone like me. This isn't me, but someone similar to me. I always see suspicious objects. Frequently. The police know my voice, I always see suspicious, what's that near, whatever. So this is a woman like my sister under the skin. They're driving. She sees a bag that looks like it has something in it in the middle of the street. So she says to her husband, Maisha, that bag is suspicious. Why is there a full bag in the middle of the street? Okay, now, he says, it's late at night, we're going home, it's just a bag, got it? B-A-G, bag, it's a bag. He says, you know, Maisha, in the morning when it explodes by that timing device that I read about, you're not going to forgive yourself, you know? Notice how it became his problem. Okay, so he went out of the car. What do Israelis do, real Israelis, who are born in Israel, not people like me, real Israelis, when they find a suspicious object, what do? Kick it! It's like real Israelis, when somebody knocks on the door, what do as they open the door? They say, Mize. Okay. Oops. hope I didn't end the world. Okay, whatever. Okay. So he opens the bag, and it's full of large denominations of dollars. Okay. That's part one. Here's part pre-one. Somebody put his house up for sale, and he agreed to give the buyer a substantial discount if he would pay the whole thing in cash. Okay, the seller was going home after the closure. Now, what happened next depends on whose story you want to believe, the husband's or the wife's. So they stopped by Angel's Bakery, bought some bread for the next day. Either the husband, who's a klutz and an idiot, wasn't watching what he was doing, and when he got out to the bakery, he let the bag with all the money fall out of the car. Or the wife, who's a clumsy idiot, etc., moved over when the husband went out of the car to get the bread and knocked the bag out and didn't notice what she did. I'm sure they discuss this frequently. Okay, so in any case, they didn't notice the money bag was gone until they got home. Could you imagine what went on in the house? Okay. So in the meantime, Moshe has the bag with all the money. How much money do you think we're talking about? Right, we're talking about a lot of money. He did everything right. He's from Ramot. He drove back to Ramot. He woke up one of the Paskenim Rabbanim in Ramot. I believe it was Rav Fuchs, I'm not sure. It's the middle of the night. He woke him up. He said, I found all this money. Is he obligated to return it? It's cash. He's not. The bag was like an ordinary grocery bag. It couldn't be easily identified. But he wanted to. He understood that there could be the joyous finder, but there's somewhere the weeping loser. So the Rav told him what to do. He said, wake up someone to act as a witness. And the Rav called his own witness. There were two witnesses there now. The Rav counted out the money in front of the witnesses. They both signed, both witnesses signed, that this is the amount of money that was in the bag. Okay, the next thing was to try to find the owner. So the idea that the Rav thought of was he contacted one of his connections who had connections in Israel Broadcasting. And he had them announce on the firm radio stations every 15 minutes that a large sum of money was found and that the loser could call Rav Fuchs. Okay? How long do you think it took before the loser of all of this money actually came? 7 hours. He wasn't listening to the radio. Okay? He was busy tearing his hair out. So it took 7 hours, but the man did come. He was able to talk about the denominations of the bills, where he had been. Okay. Now, in the meantime, the finder had gone home. He had left the money with the Rav, who gave him a receipt for it. The Rav called him up. He woke up his 6 kids, and he said, we're going to do something that we may never do again. They stopped by the Rav's house, and they brought the money to the loser. Okay, what are the words that be one of the kids? You could be that. Put yourself there. Give me some words. What? No, a kid, a teenager might say that, not a kid. What a kid? What's the words that the kids are going to think? They see their father returning all this money to somebody who's probably beyond themselves with grief and craziness. What are the words? No? Pride. Do you feel some of that? Awe. Respect. Could you see where a story like that touches the part of you that says, I want to be like that? Okay. That's what Mashiach could touch in you. The part of you that wants to be like that. Okay, so this is what redemption is about. And redemption has to do with the Jews, and ultimately, the non-Jews as well. So here's the process. The Jews do tshuva, that means he touches that part to the point that we want that. Okay, and the next step after we do tshuva is that the rest of the world is affected. And then we have the return to Eretz Yisrael, in an absolute sense, and the building of the Beis HaMikdash, and Eliyahu HaNavi coming and telling everyone what tribe they're from, who they really are, what they really need to be. Okay, let's take it this far. As I said, this shiur is not going to be about Mashiach. There's a lot more we could say. I want to talk about the period before that part was touched. The pre-Messianic age, which is where we are now. So there's also a cycle and a process. What is it? The paradigm of how things will be the exodus from Egypt and the redemption. It'll also include a second paradigm, is the building of the second Beis HaMikdash. How did it go? So there are two steps. The first is called Pekida. So Moshe came to the Jews in Egypt and he said, Hashem said, I remembered you, Pakadati, which was, so to speak, the magic word that they knew still from Yosef. But what does it mean? It means I remembered that there's a part of you that wants that. We forget it. We forget who we are. Could you see where this is so? We forget who we want to be. We forget who we wish we were. We drown in false ambition. We drown in pettiness. We drown in the desire for status and money. We forget who we really want to be. Do you understand this? So the first stage is reminding us of who we want to be. Now this could take place in one of two ways. One is, as we saw in Egypt, miracles, wonders, and the other is, as we also saw in Egypt initially, everything gets worse. Moshe came to Egypt. He says, the time has come. God's taking you out. Then what happened? Paro said, make bricks without straw. It has to get worse before it gets better. Why do you think? It has to do not only with appreciation, but something much deeper. So we have to want out. We entrap ourselves with all of the things I just mentioned. The desire for status, the desire for money, the desire for everything that blinds us to who we could be. We have to want out. So I want to talk to you about primordial fears for a moment. So there's a premise that greater fear always eclipses smaller fear. So let me illustrate this to you. How many of you are afraid of mice? Yes? Okay. So here it is. Pretend that, you know, you're asleep in bed. You have to get up to go to the bathroom. You kicked your slippers underneath the bed. You're too lazy to turn on the light to look for them, so you go barefoot. And as you're walking to the bathroom, you hear this squeak as you put your foot down. And you feel the whole body of it and the tail. Okay, go. How many of you could picture screaming? Okay? You're horrified, okay? Now, as you're like screaming about this mess, you notice that the front door is open. Now, you know you were the last one home that night. Your husband came home before you. Your kids came home before you. You were at a wedding. How'd that door get open? Do you still remember the mouse? What mouse? Okay. And just as like you're saying, well, someone might be in the house, you see the shadow of a man. He's holding a knife. Okay. Do you see the front door anymore? What door? Okay. Now, as you're like, okay, you take notice of the windows. You have a large picture window in your front, and you see this like this mushroom cloud radiating. Okay, what man? Okay, so all I'm illustrating by this horrific example is that greater fear eclipses lesser fear. We spend our lives in fear. What are some things we're afraid of? violence, rejection. What else? Death. Most people don't think about death a lot. Don't fool yourselves. What are things that people are afraid of day by day? Failure. Rejection. Insecurities about work. Rejection. Okay. Could you see where this is going? Are there people who spend their whole lives in fear? There are. These fears are all petty and destructive. So we sometimes have to let go of control. These fears feed on the concept that if you only do and then fill in the empty space, then you won't be afraid anymore. If you only make everybody like you by being exactly who they want you to be all of the time, then you don't have to be afraid of rejection. Are there people who play that game? Okay. If you only cheat in business, you'll always have money. And then you'll be okay. Do people play that game? They do. And I could fill in the other fears as well. Okay. The kind of fears we live with is something that we respond to with trying to grasp more and more control. Does it work? Does it ever work? Doesn't work. So what are we like? We're like, okay, this is a true story. It's an unfortunate story, but it's a true story. I'm not telling you this story with pride. There was Maisa Shahaya. I think it was, which war was this? I think it was during the war through after which, the war in 1954. Where the Sinai was given to Egypt. So one of the Israeli generals had used some Bedouin as his scouts, and he wanted to reward them. So he went to their little village, which is like really a tent city because they move about a lot, and he asked the sheikh, "What do you want?" And the sheikh said, "You know, I've been to a city, and I see you have these faucets that you open and water comes out of the wall. I want one of those." So he went to a hardware store, bought a faucet, installed it in a wall, and left. Okay. Wasn't the right thing to do, but that's what happened. Okay, so why am I telling you this story? Do we do this to ourselves all the time? We give ourselves the image of control because we don't know where the source of all of events that transpire are. We cut Hashem out of the picture. So because of this, it's predicted that in order for us to get to a place of really wanting to change, we have to let go of any illusion of control. Therefore, it says in the Gemara, here are some predictions for the pre-Messianic era, which is analogous to the make bricks without straw era. We'll lose faith in political systems. Is there anybody here in this room who thinks, I know how things will get better. It'll be through politics. Is there anybody who thinks that? No. Okay. We'll lose faith in economic systems. Okay. It's like the old joke. Somebody goes to a young man and says, shows him a picture of his Social Security check. He says, do you know what that is? And the man says, no. He says, you don't have to. Okay. Okay. There'll be great chutzpah. There'll be contempt. People will hold other people in contempt. Has that happened? The old will no longer be respected. Has that happened? Yes. Okay. All of this is to bring us to one place. It says, we'll recognize finally that we have no one to turn to but Avinu Shebashamayim. Then we're ready to be redeemed. So this is what all of this is happening for. It's all purposeful. None of this is coincidental. So now I want to take you back a few steps. There are some things that Rambam, who as I told you was my main source, doesn't discuss. He only discussed things whose cycles are completely predictable. But there are wild cards or things that could happen this way, but then again they could happen what? That way. So one of the things under discussion is the era of Mashiach ben Yosef. In the Gemara it says, and again we have this pakida, we're being brought to desperation, At that time, there'll be a yearning to return to the land. Just like in Egypt, the Jews were willing to leave Mitzrayim to go to parts unknown. Just like in the time of building Bayit Sheni, there was a promise of return after we were sick of what our lives were like, and some people returned. What's the purpose of the first return, the era of Mashiach ben Yosef? So the Gra explains that unlike Mashiach ben David, who's an actual person, just like Moshe was an actual person, Mashiach ben Yosef is the name of an era, not the name of a person. Mashiach ben Yosef's era is the era of the initial return to the land. What's that for? Why is there initial return to the land? So the purpose of the initial return to the land, the Gra says, is in order to bring us to this place that we've just described, of reliance on Hashem. When you keep the mitzvot that are tliyot ba'aretz, and when you live in Eretz Yisrael in general, you have a far greater and clearer picture of Hashem's control over events. So let's look at just two things. Let's look at the Shemitah cycle, and let's look at the Gulf War. I can go on and on about this. I'm going to keep it to these two things. You've read the articles about the Shemitah cycle, have you not? So I'm going to just share my own experience with you. It's not as dramatic as the famous Koma Miyot story. It's less dramatic than that. We were living for a while in a moshav in the north called Segev. What? You never heard of Segev? Why, if you blink on the old, not new, Akko Tveria highway, you'll miss it. Okay, clear? There's really no reason why anybody would ever go there unless they live there. Okay, so in any case, our nearest Jewish neighbors, who were not near, it's in the middle of Arabsville, was a moshav shitufi called Yodfat, which is extreme left, like so far left that if the world was flat, they would have fallen off the edge a long time ago. You know, everything, like they had a spiritual evening once. They decided they should have an Erev Ruchani, so they invited the monks from an Arab village to talk to them about spirituality. Okay, you have the picture? Okay, so here it is. The way they, the way Segev supported itself was that everybody had like some level of agricultural interest. We had chickens, other people had other things, but everybody also had real world jobs. Okay, in Yodfat, they took working the land much more seriously, and they supported themselves primarily through growing flowers for export. So they would grow flowers, export them to Holland so they could be marked Holland, and from there to the whole world. Okay, so it was before Shemitah. Now, in the flower business, you have to harvest immediately because the flowers don't last. So, although they believed in principle in having Jewish labor, in fact, they had this whole Arab hamula, that's like this whole clan, who would help them with harvesting. They were in good relationships with them. So, the father of the Arab clan went to the maskir of Yodfat at the beginning of Shemitah, and he said to him, why don't you put your money in chickens like they do in Segev? That's better. And the man's looking at him like he's crazy. We're making good money on the flowers. They're not making good money on the chickens. We're set up for the flowers. We have all the equipment. We have everything going for us. Why would we want to change to chickens? So the man just walked away. So that year, they planted as always. First, there was no rain at all, so their initial crops all dried out. Then they replanted, and there was torrential rain, so that all of the seeds that were on a hilltop flowed down to the valley where the Arabs lived, and the Arab family harvested all the flowers and made the profit. So they were saying, how did he know this? How did you know that we wouldn't make any money this year? And he said, don't you know? So he said, no what? So he's expecting like some folkloric answer or something, like the winds are this. Every 7 years, nothing grows good for the Jews. Okay? Don't you know this, he said? Okay, that was my experience with Shemitah. So the same Moshav, Yodfat, where again, they're very far. When, I'm going to skip the Gulf War for a moment. Okay, the Yom Kippur War. The Yom Kippur War was a very ugly war. I don't know if you appreciate how ugly it was. The first days were indescribably horrific. Close to 1,000 soldiers were lost in the first 3 days. And nobody really knew what was going on. This was before computers. And, if you turn on the radio, they were like, not everyone knew they weren't telling us the truth, but we didn't know what the truth was. Now, the Yom Kippur War obviously started when? Yom Kippur, that's why it's called the Yom Kippur, whatever. So, when the army authorities came to Segev to get the men, they thought it was just some ploy, like, you just knew we're all religious, we'd all be home, like, forget it. You've tried this kind of thing before. We'll go Mitzvah Yom Kippur. They went to Yotfat, and the men had no problem. Sure, let's go. So the result was that the men of Yotfat were fighting a day before the men of Segev. Okay? Now, the army has a policy, which is after 3 days, they send the men home for a little bit of R&R because nobody could fight sustained much longer than that. So the result of that is the men of Yotfat were coming home a day before anybody in Segev knew what was going on. So we got a phone call. If you want to know what's really happening, because we all knew we didn't know the truth, they're going to be home today by 4. Come listen. So we walked over the hills, which only later we found out was crazy dangerous, because we didn't know. But we didn't know. We walked over the hills to Yotfat. We get there. So I want you to see this. In a normal size Israeli living room, maybe 60 people are there. Everybody, these are small moshavot. The whole population of Yotfat and some of the people of Segev. The soldiers came in. We're Jewish, so do we say, why don't you lie down, rest, we'll wait patiently? No. What's happening? Okay. So the oldest of the group, who I still remember, he was 30, which to me at the time seemed very old. Very old, very wise, we were all very young. Okay, he said, we saw miracles. Do you all know what cognitive dissonance is? Good words, but coming out of the wrong mouth. So everybody said, huh? Okay. And he said, you know how we learned Chumash as literature in school, which is how the Israelis learned it in the secular world? Remember how it says, 100 people will pursue 1,000, and 1,000 people will pursue 10,000? That's what happened the first day. The Arabs were very close to Tzfat. They could have taken Tzfat easily. There was plenty of daylight. And they made camp. It was as though they were waiting for us. And when they saw us, they ran away. Okay, so he said that was a miracle. Is this the exception or the rule in Israel? It's the rule. So now I'll move you up to the Gulf War. How many explosives were sent to Israel during the Gulf War? 100, 200, 500? No one, thousands, and nobody knows still. How many of them actually hit anything?
One.
No, they hit targets, but there was only one fatality. Okay? Now, at the time, even though we were supposed to be in sealed rooms, some people, I'm not saying this is good or wise, wanted to see what was going on. So if one happened to stand on the top of the roof of one's building, which was not a wise thing to do, one could see the explosions sort of exploding in mid-air, especially over Shmuel HaNavi. So at the time, one might have thought that the Israeli Air Force had anti-aircraft weaponry they were using. It was only afterwards we found out that nobody really knows why they exploded midair. So this is the rule. So the purpose of the Tkufa of Mashiach ben Yosef is to make us want that. The moments of closeness, the moments of dependency, the moments of faith. It's meant to bring us back. So in terms of response to this era, what's the worst response to all of the turbulence? What's the worst response? Business as usual. It's the worst response. The response of the Jews in Egypt, Paro will die, and there'll be a change of government, and everything's going to be what? Hunky-dory? No. Be in reality. Don't escape. The turbulence is real. It's there to draw us close. And there are predictions of how things will happen. The end, in one of the Maharal's forum, he talks about what the end will look like. He says that there'll be alliances between Edom and Yishmael, as we find that Esav married Yishmael's daughter. And the final edge of Galus Edom, which is the exile that we're in now, will involve battling with Yishmael. And he tells us what the battle will be about. It'll be about land. It's completely predicted. It'll be about land. Okay, so as we observe, this is where we are. Is it or not? So what are the concrete things we should do with it? So the first thing and most important thing is be there. By be there, I mean acknowledge what's happening, acknowledge that this is meant to draw us closer, be willing to have more faith. So bringing this into your lives, you have the American economic crisis. Okay, what's the worst response? What crisis? Just everybody knows, doesn't have a job. Okay, whatever. Okay, be there. Instead of relying on the political system to change things, ask God for help. There are bizarre political occurrences. Okay, instead of saying, wow, that's interesting, who would have thought? Okay, draw yourself close. Everybody knows what distances them. Everybody is different. Is that true or not? It's time to draw closer, each person in their own way. Okay, are there any collective instructions that we have? We have the general ones that have to do, you know what keeps you far, I know what keeps me far. Are there any things that are more general than that? So there's a rule which is, tikkun always has to come from the place where the breakage is. Where's our place of breakage? Where's our weakest point? So again, if we look at history, at the cycles, okay, the second Beis HaMikdash, which is the direct cause of our contemporary exile, was brought about by what? Sinas Chinam. Now, there are two things that are difficult here. First of all, nobody hates someone for no reason at all. And there's what on earth does Sinas Chinam have to do with any of this? So let's look at the second thing first. Why should you like anyone? Did you ever wonder about this? You're from New York. You could, you know. Why like anyone? You know, I remember. You know how most people, like, won't say what they really think in this regard? Like, you know, why like people? People are, you know, they are what they are. You know, they get in your way, they, whatever. Okay, so I want to tell you another story. You're all familiar with the Itamar tragedy, right? The tragedy that took place in Itamar. Okay. Anybody here doesn't know what I'm talking about? Okay. So on the Friday of the Shiva, the remaining children who stay are by the mother's parents who live in Yerushalayim. Okay. They had an interesting visitor. Many people were coming throughout the Shiva. Rami Levy showed up. Any of you know who he is? He has a supermarket with 400 branches in Israel. Very interesting person. He started out with nothing. He was born in the area of Machane Yehuda. And as a young person, he noticed that if you sell lots and lots and lots of whatever, you make as much profit as when you sell less, but at a higher markup. So his discount grocery stores are very popular. Okay, and he showed up, was on a Friday, with a big order. And he came himself. He didn't send a delivery man. Okay, he told the family, you better get used to seeing me because I'm going to be here every Friday till the youngest child is 18. So you hear the story. What do you think inspired him to do this? What was he thinking? Where could I dump the extra groceries? No, that's not what he was thinking. What was he thinking?
I mean, faceless love.
You're saying, I am these people. You understand what I'm saying? The mechitza that separates him from the family, from the Fogel family, fell down. Okay, so that's what Avas Chinam means. It means, I am the other person. That doesn't mean you don't see the other person's faults, just like you see your own faults. But you feel part and connected. When you feel part and connected, then on some level you're in touch with what we spoke about at the very beginning when we spoke about the uniqueness of Jewish fate and destiny. We're in the same boat. So part of saying that we want return is acknowledging that it's we, not just me, that there's a puzzle with thousands and thousands of pieces, and the puzzle isn't whole if even one piece isn't in place. So the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because of estrangement. We worshipped idols, killed each other, were sexually immoral. That wasn't ever really healed. But we came back because at least we wanted as a whole to return. The will was there. But when we lose the collective, we lose the will. So the one thing that we have to be focused upon in these times, in addition to wanting return, is wanting to return together. So how do you achieve that? A minute ago I said, why like people? People aren't always so likable. So what do you do with that? People are not always so likable. We all have in-laws. No, sorry. Okay, but so what awakens love is a feeling of connection, and what develops the feeling of connection is giving. Everybody you encounter needs. Some people need an ear that listens. Some people need eye contact. Some people need concrete physical help. Some people need information. When you approach anyone else, you ask yourself two questions. What could I learn from him? And what could I give him? Those two questions are the source of feeling at one with another person. And we're getting towards the end. Now, this is like watching a movie where you know the end. We know the end. The only question is who will be at the end. We know the end. Mashiach will come. Well, no matter where Hashem has to take us before we're willing to relinquish control, he'll take us there. How far he has to go depends on us. But we'll return, and it'll be okay. We have to ask, and who will we be? Will we be fighting for it, or will we be fighting against it? So I'm going to leave you with that. And if you have questions, this is the time.
Why didn't Hashem do the other way that he did in Egypt, through miracles and openness? Why does he have to go through the suffering and through the...
So there are two stages. The first is Pekida, which they had in Egypt. When they responded and they were ready to notice miracles and relate to him, that's what happened. But there has to be at least a relinquishment of control.
So we are also...
If we can get ourselves there. There's a lot that's left to us. Yeah?
You said that through Abraham, we all respect life.
Right.
So how do we factor in those terrorists who don't respect life?
We all have the... I should have been more clear. We all have the potential to respect life. We could work against our own potentials. I heard in the Itamar murders, which appalled me the most, did you know they went back for the baby? They were out of the house and they went back for the baby. That's what people could become. Yeah. You're asking the wrong person. Yesterday. What do you mean when? Yesterday. I'm not going to put my foot in that mouth, okay? What I'm saying, there are many shitas about obligation or not obligation. There's no havamin in halacha that it's not a mitzvah. The question is whether it's an obligation or not. But that it's a mitzvah, it's certainly a mitzvah. And that we have, for anyone who could go to cheat themselves out of that level of closeness, it seems to me stupid. So spiritually, it's only better there. Who should make Aliyah? Everybody. When? Yesterday. You know, like, don't press that button with me. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So the coping mechanism you could have while this is all going on is to trust Hashem that He knows what He's doing. That he'll take you wherever He has to take you, but He's taking you in the end towards where you want to be. You could say, enough already, more, ad matai. That's what Daniel said. When Daniel saw the vision of what we might have to go through until we're ready to let go of control, you know what he said to Hashem? Ad matai. He asked the Geula to come Barachamim, because if Hashem was waiting for us to be ready, you know, okay, so we could ask for Ge'ula Barachamim. It's a reasonable thing to ask for. So the Sfasemis talks about it like this. He says you could be in Eretz Yisrael and not be in Eretz Yisrael. How so? Imagine that you're a very untactful person. You have just like no sensitivity. So you have a deaf friend. And you say to your deaf friend in sign, let's go out together tonight. And she says, sure, and you take her to the opera. Okay. Now, this is stupid. So the idea is that a person has to have a certain level of inner readiness to be able to experience what's happening around them. So for sure there are some people whose gullus is deeper and darker and some people whose gullus is less deep and dark. For sure that's true. But in the paradigm of Mitzrayim, the people got out together. Now you could argue that then many people didn't make it, but in Yechezkel he says that it'll be different in the last time than it was in the first time in that regard. Yeah?
I was invited here by my daughter who's studying with you in Israel.
Uh-huh.
Now what happens when she comes home and the whole family says, you're crazy, what are you talking about?
Yes. So that's probably a direct quote. Okay, so at this point, I want to talk to you about the problem of what I would call the goldfish. Let's say I have a goldfish. Her name is Goldie. She lives in the goldfish bowl. So she goes around and around and around. Now I interview her one day, have my microphone. I'm sure you've noticed that as long as you carry a microphone, you could ask anybody anything, and they think they have to answer you. The microphone doesn't even have to be connected to anything. Okay. So I say, Goldie, what's the world like? Do you really know what the world's like? I'm a sophisticated being. There's bookcase, window, wall, and couch. Bookcase, window, wall, couch. And I've been around. There's also, you could do it backwards. Wall, window, bookcase, okay. And on top there's ceiling, okay. I've seen it all. So one approach to life is what in philosophy you call empirical evidence. If I've seen it, it's real, and if I haven't seen it, it's not real. Okay, the problem with empirical evidence is it leaves no room for anything bigger than one's ego and one's imagination. So there was a philosophy professor at City College in the 20s, who would argue, this theory in philosophy is called positivism, okay, which is different than positivism in psychology. Okay, he would go to a class, he was a secular man, and he would say there are things that are not empirical. And the students would say, like, and he'd whistle Dixie. And he'd say, what happened? So they'd say, he whistled Dixie, and he said, where is it? And they would have to answer him that It's where? It's in their consciousness, their memory. Okay. So what I'm saying is when people say you're crazy, almost invariably what they mean is this doesn't match my empirical reality. But when you look at the history of the Jews, nothing ever matched anybody's empirical reality. If you were to ask your great-grandmother how likely it would be that she would have a great-great-granddaughter studying Torah in Jerusalem in English, what would she say?
You're crazy.
You're crazy. See, that's it. You know, that's why, like, when a person converts, how does it work? So the person who is a prospective convert goes to the rabbi. His role is to see if this person really will fit in, whether that fits his soul, because why shouldn't he be who he is? So he has to discourage him and see. So the first thing he has to tell him is, you know, there are a lot of mitzvot, and a lot of them are very costly. Like what? What costs a lot of money? Etrog. School tuition. Etrog. Okay. Okay, so the person comes back and says, you know, no matter what it costs, I want to be on. So then he has to say, well, you know, you could be a very good person, draw close to God without being Jewish. There are so many commandments. Why don't you just live a normal life? They're numerous. And once you're in, you can't get out. Okay? So he comes back a third time. He says, I want in, no matter what I have to pay. And he says, you'll be a member of a persecuted people. And then he says, I want in anyway. I'd rather be on the trains too than the people putting people on the trains too. And he says, you're nuts. You're in.
So that's a good thing.
Yeah. Okay. Going once. Yeah. Us get together? What? No, Mashiach could not have come at any time. This is why when Rambam says, wait, he can come now, he meant from his time onward. He did not mean that it could have been earlier unless we had extraordinary merit. If we would have had extraordinary merit, that would be a different thing. But no, we haven't gotten it together. That's the problem. The problem is we didn't ever get it together. So the question is how when time runs out will we get it together? So either our backs will be pushed to the wall or there'll be a great act of mercy. The Chafetz Chaim predicts that no matter how far we're pushed, it's unlikely we'll get it together, and in the end it'll come through mercy. Okay, yeah? What? Okay. Wait! A pause. Whenever I come to Chutz Laaretz, I collect tzedakah for various causes. So I'm going to send around my tzedakah envelopes. So the first one is Nevei Kalas. They come to Israel. They become religious. They meet young men. It costs money. Okay, that's okay. You guys pay. Okay. Next is for Lev La'achim. Lev La'achim is an organization in Israel that promotes drawing people away from assimilation in Israel. There are girls who have been taken out of Arab villages by the Lev La'achim volunteers. They need money. Okay? It does other things as well, but that's one of their things. And the last one is my son-in-law consistently collects money for a particular family. The husband of this family is not well mentally, and the wife isn't a good coper. And for years now, he's been helping them out financially. My son-in-law's name is Shmuel Kaplan. It says Kaplan on the envelope. It's not for him. It's for the family that he helps. Okay. Any more questions? Yeah, Naz? Okay. Okay, so I'm going to rephrase your question. Is there any justification in differentiating between the Israeli government and Eretz Israel? So if you would have asked that question 30 years ago, you could raise a lot of very heavy passion. Today, I don't think in Israel very many people idealize the government. There was a time people would hear the word Ben-Gurion. Nobody hears BB and goes, I mean, it might be. It's because the government has demonstrated that with all of their heroism and good intents, that they are what they are. I want to tell you a true story that was, again, in my Segev Yodfat days. So one of our friends who lived in Yodfat, when he was called up to Miluim, his job was to be a tank ima. Do you know what that is? So a tank, most tanks have 12 people. There are gunners, navigators, they switch back and forth. But there's also someone's job, it's the least glamorous job in the army, other than the kitchen, is to be the tank ima. To make sandwiches, to, you know, see everything is clean and orderly. So he's a tank ima. So one of the things his job required was that when radio messages came in, he had to see that they were transferred to the right person. If it's supposed to go to the navigator should get it. If it's supposed to go to the commander should get it. If it's supposed to go to the gunner should get it. He had to work the electronic device that sent the messages to the right person. Now, from where he sat, there was a little portal, and he could see what's going on around him. So he could see they were in battle, and the Syrians were coming from the north to the south. He heard a command that was supposed to be sent up to the commander to turn north to get away from the Syrians. And he realized that whoever's giving this command got it wrong. So the north is where they're coming from. You can't escape them by going north. So he had to make a choice in 1 second. What's the choice he had to make? To transmit the command or to not transmit the command? One of the worst things you could do in an army, any army, is to either disobey a command or not transmit a command. So this has been like drilled into him, transmit the command. But his eyes told him that the tank going into the Syrians is a bad idea. So he didn't transmit the command. By doing that, he probably saved the tank. Okay, afterwards, he had a big... he had a moment of, like, one of these moments of awakening where he realized the people in the high command are the same people who run the economy. They're the same people who run the traffic system. The reason why we survive isn't them. So the Medina as a whole has reached this point of realization. I would say the turning point was the Gush Katif episode. So at this point, most people in Israel, secular as well as religious, love Israel, love the people of Israel, are willing to make sacrifices for Israel, but don't take the government as a semi-divine body. So Yom Ha'atzmaut 30 years ago was a very serious day. Yom Ha'atzmaut today is make a barbecue. It's like, it's the people who, in America, who are trying to bring things back to how they were in Israel 30 years ago are not living in reality, not since Gush Katif.
Do we believe that the truth that Israel has a government?
Of course it's good that they have a government. It would be nice if the government acknowledged that all it is a government and not the realization of our messianic yearning. Of course they should have a government, otherwise we'd have anarchy. Of course there has to be a government. But the same way, any country has to have a government. Not bigger than that, not smaller than that.
So why don't they encourage more Israeli propaganda, whatever you want to call it, in more of Israeli schools?
So as far as I know, in terms of praying for Israel, benefiting Israel, giving tzedakah to Israel, they do this. It's the idealization of the government in which there was so much division at this point. As I would say, in Eretz Yisrael at this point, there's really, between my grandson who's a settler and my son who learns in Brisk, there's very little disagreement about what they think of the government. Okay. Okay.
Hours so I can see you.